Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everybody to the Dragon's Lair. Tonight's topic, the numerology of 9/11, at least some of it anyway. There's so much of it that who knows how much there could be. And I'm sure so many people have worked on it. They've all made discoveries and some may have been shared, some not. But I've got a fairly good article here to go over. For the record, today is October 11th, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 18 degrees Libra. I have no website or blog. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com. That is magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to be on my e-list, just send me an email saying subscribe. Otherwise, you can just write me. Can't guarantee I can respond to all of my emails, but I will read them. No calls tonight, as usual. Cat's under the computer table. Dog is in the other room. Hopefully he won't be a pest tonight. Sometimes he hears me talking in here, and if he can't get in here, he thinks he's missing something. So anyway, we'll see how that goes. But a little bit about this article here. I don't remember exactly when it was written, but it was in the early 2000s, shortly after 9/11. The person who wrote it accepted the theory of the official story or theory, whatever way you want to describe it as, from the government that 19 Arabs, hijacked three planes, and you know the story. So this has a lot of issues related to the Quran in it, which is also, it's interesting. But what it winds up being is, ultimately, it's sort of an article based upon the Templars versus the Muslims. And that's how the author did this. But it's got a lot of good information. Unfortunately, this author is fully aware of the Knights Templar being the predecessor to Freemasonry. And I don't know who exactly wrote it, but it came off of a website that had to do with Richard Hoagland and one of his friends, something like that. I don't remember the guy's name exactly, but it's worth a listen. And there is one reference to NASA in there, and it's Masonic correlation, but other than that, it's all pretty much straightforward 9/11. So anyway, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and play another song like I usually do, and then we'll get into the article right after that. And so here is some Clannad. Thank you. Okay, I'm back. Just want to go ahead and mention, you know, I've been trying different combinations here of ways to do these shows with my headsets and the computers and everything else. And so I'm repeating what I did last night. However, when I listened to the recording from last night, it sounded a little bit distorted. It was loud enough, but it wasn't really clear. And I don't know if that was because the volume level for the recording was a little high or if there was some other issue. So tonight I've got the volume on the microphone turned down just a hair, and we'll see how this goes. And so anyway, go ahead and get started here. Let's see here. It says, as we first reported to you last year in our admittedly end-of-day series, and that is what this is part of here. It's called Who's the Enemy? The End of Days Begun? Question mark. We believe that the world has crossed a Rubicon into a new and extremely dangerous phase. The portent of this new period was defined by the passing of Sirius across the Giza Meridian at precisely 12 midnight on January 1st, 2000, an event which we have shown could not have been coincidental. At that time, we asserted that this singular event, dictated by a series of deft manipulations of the Western Gregorian calendar, had been planned and worked towards for perhaps two millennia. The authors of this extraordinary and meticulously planned celestial event were a series of groups which have come to be loosely known as secret societies. Semi-hidden bands of hand-picked and self-appointed leaders who frequently attempt to manipulate secular political events. Yet still, when we first witnessed this horrific acts of terror and cowardice, remember what I said, these people believed that the Arabs did 9/11, of terror and cowardice that brought down New York's twin World Trade Center towers, it simply did not occur to us that we might be witnessing such a manipulated event. Random acts happen. Violent, murderous thugs commit unspeakable acts of murder against innocent people every day. The world is full of religious and political zealots who seek to either convert or kill those that refuse to bend to their will. This, in our initial reaction to the horror, most likely was the case with this worst single attack on American soil in our history. Actually, I would think Pearl Harbor was. Depends on how you want to define it and measure it. But we knew about that. The Japanese still did it, but we knew it was coming. Then the numbers began to come in. It became obvious fairly early that there were some strange coincidences surrounding these events. As was quickly reported throughout the internet, there were a whole bunch of odd 9/11 and 11 coincidences that linked to these horrific attacks. For instance, the attacks took place on 9/11. 9 plus 1 plus 1 equal 11. Each World Trade Center tower had 110 floors, which is a multiple of 11. The aircraft which ultimately hit the Pentagon was American Airlines Flight 77. 77 is another multiple of 11. American Airlines Flight 11, the first plane flown into World Trade Center Tower 2, had 11 crew members. A total of 65 people were on Flight 11. 6 plus 5 equal 11. The second plane, United Airlines Flight 175, hit the World Trade Tower 1 at 9:02 a.m. 9 plus 2 equal 11. 9/11 is the 254th day of the year. 2 plus 5 plus 4 equal 11. After 9/11, there are 111 days left in the year. New York City, where the major attack occurred, consisted of 11 letters. New York State was the 11th state admitted into the Union. And I want to interject something here. Now, even though they believe this was an actual event pulled off by 19 Arabs, etc., you know, the people doing this still would have put all of this stuff together to begin with, simply because, number one, it helps with the story they want to tell everybody, and the magic involved, so to speak. And I won't elaborate that on that too much here. It's just, if you understand how magic works, all of this stuff is just par for the course, basically. I don't know how else to describe it without getting into a whole nother conversation on the topic. So, anyway, President Bush ordered flags to fly at half-mast until 9:22, making an 11-day period of mourning, and so on. At this point, our interest had been piqued, but little else. We had no way of knowing or certainly proving whether all of these resonances were simply true coincidence or part of some other larger pattern. But given our previous research into such recurring symbolism, we felt impelled to at least look. The first place we started was the date itself. As many news agencies immediately pointed out, the week of 9/11 is the week of the Camp David Accords, which made peace between Israel and Egypt in 1978, with an official signing on March 26, 1979. But that seemed a little bit too simplistic, so we kept digging. As it turns out, 9/11 is also an ancient date of special Middle Eastern significance. September the 11th is New Year's Day in the ancient Egyptian Coptic Christian calendar. That the day must still hold special significance to the people of Egypt is reflected by the fact that Egypt ratified its current constitution on that same day in 1971. But what immediately bothered us was this question: why would a terrorist pick this day, a day of unique significance to Christians in Egypt, against targets in a primarily Judeo-Christian country like the United States, and why these particular targets? As we demonstrated in End of Days, the U.S. was founded essentially as a great Masonic experiment. Most of the driving forces and compelling personalities behind the American Revolution originated in the Masonic lodges of the time. The evidence of a pervasive Masonic influence is present throughout our culture, then and now, in our symbols. Looked at the dollar bill lately? Architecture. How about the Washington Monument? And traditions. What is the real reason July 4th is celebrated as Independence Day? Okay, well, I'm going to interject something. While we're on that topic of the Independence Day, if you you may have caught it in one of my other appearances on another host on another network show. I don't think I ever said it on mine. Let me clear my throat here real quick. But the way our country was set up was to create a grand shrine. And that means that you have points in the calendar or the astrological chart that are 120 degrees apart from each other. And so you have Independence Day in early July, which is in the middle of Cancer. Then you have voting in early November, which is in the middle of Scorpio. And then you had Inauguration Day in Pisces, which was the middle of March. Now, what's happened is since Roosevelt, they changed the Inauguration Day to January, and that's kind of thrown a wrench in this grand trine. So, anyhow, I'll discuss that more in detail at a later point, but I just wanted to mention that here. But we'll get into the other significance of July 4th here later on in this article. And by the way, this is a pretty long article. I don't know if I will finish it tonight or not. If I don't, it'll just have to be picked up at the as part of another show. I don't know how long it's going to take. You know, it could take 2 hours, 2.5 hours, hopefully no longer than that, but it might. Depends on how many times I stop and how many songs I decide to play. As we demonstrated, okay, well, I've already read that, sorry. What is not commonly known is that the roots of modern Freemasonry extend far beyond the mid-18th century, all the way back to ancient Egypt, and more importantly, through a Middle Ages movement commonly known as the Knights Templar. It is, we now suspect, the remnants of this Templar Masonic American axis that were the true target of these attacks. In other words, September 11th was a direct thrust at the heart of the American Revolutionary Experiment in the critical year, see below, of 2001. Now, I think one could say that if one looks at who was really behind this event, right? Do I need to say more? So that would still apply. As we did in the end of days, before we lay out the remarkable evidence we have now found that makes this conclusion inescapable, we must take you through something of a history lesson. Let us quote again from that previous research. In 1095 AD, you'll notice a recursion of a decimal of the critical 19.5 symbolism. Pay attention to that. 19.5. So in 1095 AD, Pope Urban II declared a holy war against the Muslim invaders of the Holy Land and launched an effort to retake the sacred city of Jerusalem. The infamous Crusades had thus begun. And by the way, 19.5 is also the cycle of the moon's nodes through the zodiac. It takes 19 years to go through every degree of all of the 12 signs. And the moon's nodes is simply the point on the ecliptic where the path of the moon crosses it. And these points move as the moon moves and the earth rotates. And these points will also have a forward motion and retrograde motion. And so that's one of the reasons why it would take 19 and a half years to cycle through the zodiac. In 1099, this was accomplished. Then in 1113, a new order was formed within the Catholic Church that came to be known as the Knights Hospitallers. One of the original members of this order, St. Bernard of Clairvaux, also created a monastery in Saborga in northern Italy in 1113. I'm not sure I said that. May have said that right. Saborga? Documents found in this ancient monastery state that it was built to protect a great secret. Later, nine knights, this number will become important later, split off from the original Knights Hospitallers, and all dependent on one another through a complex series of family relationships, presented themselves to King Boudoin. I've never been able to pronounce this. B-A-U-D-O-I-N. Boudoin I of Jerusalem in 1118, requesting the duty of keeping Christian pilgrims safe on the roads and highways leading to the holy city from the port of Jaffa. And of course, that's all bullshit, but that's the official fiction. And it would take certainly more than nine knights to do it, but there's a reason for using the number nine here, I'm sure. Obviously, such a task was far beyond the capabilities of a mere nine men, and the entire protection gambit was a ruse concealing another agenda for public consumption. Upon arrival in Jerusalem, the knights, under the patronage of this Vatican-appointed monarch of Jerusalem, proceeded directly to the Temple Mount, the ancient site of the Temple of Solomon, and immediately began excavating the even then ancient ruin. It is for this work that they received their name, the Knights of the Temple, or Knights Templar. Now, just FYI, Solomon never existed. the temple that's there was built by King Herod, who was a Edomite Jew, and he was the local ruler for the Romans, the local potentate. There never was a temple before that. That's just a story. According to Knight and Lomas in the Hiram Key, which is a book, the Temple of Solomon was a structure designed under the precepts of sacred geometry by the earliest progenitors of Freemasonry and was laid out in such a way as to invoke the essence of the Egyptian myths of Isis and Osiris. According to the Royal British Engineers, who later examined the excavations of the Templars in 1867, the Knights in 1118 found a secret room beneath the Temple Mount, apparently knowing exactly what they were looking for and where to find it. Just what they found is the subject of legend, but it has gained scholarly support recently. According to the European Templar Heritage Research Network, it says, on the exterior of Chartres Cathedral, by the north door, and this is in Scotland. That's not the cathedral I'm thinking of. Or is it? Anyway, I'm momentarily confused. Roslyn Chapel is what I'm thinking of in Scotland. Okay, never mind. On the exterior of the Chartres Cathedral, by the north door, there's a carving on a pillar which gives us an indication of the object sought by the burrowing Templars, representing the Ark of the Covenant, but in a rather strange context. The Ark is depicted as being transported on a wheeled vehicle. Legend recounts that the Ark of the Covenant had been secreted deep beneath the temple in Jerusalem centuries before the fall of the city to the Romans. It had been hidden there to protect it from yet another invading army who had laid the city to waste. Hugh de Payne, one of the original nine Templar knights, had been chosen to lead the expedition mounted to locate the Ark and bring it back to Europe. Persistent legends recount that the Ark was then hidden for a considerable time deep beneath the crypt of the Chartres Cathedral. The same legends also claim that the Templars found many other sacred artifacts from the old Jewish temple in the course of their investigations, and that a considerable quantity of documentation was also located during the dig. While there has been much speculation as to the exact nature of these documents, a reasonable consensus is emerging that they contain scriptural scrolls, treatises on sacred geometry, and details of certain knowledge, art, and science, the hidden wisdom of the ancient initiates of the Judaic Egyptian tradition. Until very recently, these legends received short shrift from academic historians, but that the situation is undergoing considerable change. One modern archaeological discovery tends to support the speculative scenario that the Templars knew where to look and precisely what they were seeking. The Copper Scroll, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls discovered at Qumran, tends to confirm not only the objective of the Templar excavations, but also, albeit indirectly, give some credence to the bizarre concept of the transmission of knowledge through the generations that led to the original Templar discovery underneath the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. The Copper Scroll, which was unrolled and deciphered at Manchester University under the guidance of John Allegro, was a list of all the burial sites used to hide the various items, both sacred and profane, described as the treasure of the Temple of Jerusalem. Many of these sites have been re-excavated since the discovery of the Copper Scroll, and several of them have disclosed not temple treasure, but evidence of Templar excavation made in the 12th century. And I want to say something here before it slips my mind again. And let me clear my throat first. These Knights Hospitallers and Templars are the descendants of the Merovingian dynasties that were overthrown when Christians conquered Europe, and Charlemagne forced Christianity on to the Europeans by the sword. And keep in mind that these Templars and Hospitallers are probably just going along to get along, but have a secret agenda in mind for what they're looking for. But what we're giving you here is some of the main basic facts as they are understood outside of that issue. Okay, back to the article. After their excavations were completed at the Temple Mount, the knights returned to their native lands. Two of them ventured to Roslyn, Scotland, where they set up their headquarters. Shortly afterwards, the knights were given the official seal of the Roman Catholic Church, and their numbers swelled as wealthy landowners and aristocrats joined their ranks. Well, they were wealthy landowners and aristocrats to begin with. The Templars went on a binge of temple construction and brought back many sciences, such as astronomy, from the Holy Land. Their order grew in stature, wealth, and power quickly, and they won battle after battle against the Muslims during the various Crusades. Their secret power was supposedly that they held possession of a piece of the true cross of the crucifixion of Christ, probably found in the Temple Mount excavations. This gave them powers over their enemies in battle, and they were said to have never lost a battle while in possession of the cross. Of course, we know that's garbage, but let me take a quick drink here. They eventually lost the cross in the Battle of Hattin, H-A-T-T-I-N, in 1187 to the Muslim Saladin. That's S-A-L-A-D-I-N. After marching on July 2nd, the Templars were surrounded and cut off from water supplies. On July 4th, they broke ranks in thirst and panic, abandoned the encampment and the cross, and were wiped out by Muslim forces. These two dates later would become crucial, not only in the Templar-inspired formation of the United States of America, as we shall see, but in the continuing hidden ritual history of NASA as well, and that's what I was talking about. The only thing I'll say about NASA here is that you know that there's a cult involved, because they'll like set launch times. You know, like, why not just launch the damn thing at like 10 a.m. or something? You know, I mean, what's the point of 9:43 and 30 seconds, you know? I mean, that's the kind of thing that they would do. You know, what difference would it really make if it was just slightly off? I mean, I understand the reason part of it is the location to Earth to the moon from the launch location. And then, of course, on the way back, that has to be calculated in the same way. But being a fraction of a second off should not make any difference. Let me light this cigarette. And of course, all of the symbolism of NASA is all Masonic. Okay, back to the article. Ultimately, despite the loss of the cross, the Templars apparently became a threat to the church itself. The Pope and the nearly broke King of France, Philippe le Bel, who lived from 1268 to 1314, plotted to undermine the order and seize the considerable treasuries in France. Now, that's treasuries of the Templars. On Friday, October 13th, 1307, the king's men moved against the knights and arrested many of them. This is also why Friday the 13th is now considered unlucky. I got to clear my throat again, sorry. Although the papal conspiracy with King Philip succeeded in obtaining various confessions under torture and a considerable sum of Templar wealth, the conspirators never found the ultimate Templar treasure itself, which by now had been secreted away to Scotland. I don't remember if this says much about that anymore or not, but more than likely it found its way to what is now Canada. Nova Scotia, probably, if I remember correctly. That won't be discussed in this article, but maybe one day. It is rather interesting. So, and they were certainly aware of the Americas at the time. This is way before Columbus. Okay. Even so, most of the order was wiped out in the 1013 raid. The leader, Jacques de Molay, was burned at the stake, and his members scattered across Europe and beyond. On March 22, 1312, the church officially dissolved the order by papal bull. This date also subsequently became significant not only in the National Socialist movement in Germany, but also was another recurring NASA ritual date. Surviving German members formed the Teutonic Knights, and the Scottish members went underground, only to eventually reemerge as the Freemasons. And they went multiple places. Some went to Spain, and some went to what is now Switzerland, obviously. If you look close enough, I think you'll find a connection between the Templars and the Swiss banking. And, of course, it is the Swiss Guard who guards the Vatican, right? How odd. Okay. Whatever ancient relics and treasures the Templars held from their Jerusalem and other Holy Land, really, not holy, okay, excavations, they were from this moment on secreted away beneath Roslyn Chapel in Scotland in much the same way these artifacts were once buried under the Temple Mount itself. And I'm going to go ahead and interject something again. Sorry to keep doing this, but there were some people who tried to slant drill underneath Roslyn Chapel to uncover anything that might be under there. And then when the authorities found out about it, they put a halt to it. But the chapel has been undergoing some sort of restoration and protection to where, in other words, they had to do something for it or else it was going to continue to rapidly deteriorate. And so they're not going to ever let anybody go underneath it. And more than likely, if anything was ever underneath it, it's already gone. So anyway, it's a curiosity nonetheless. The chapel itself bears no resemblance to a Christian structure, as many experts who have surveyed it have verified. Remarkably, it is laid out alongside the same architectural lines as the biblical dimensions given for the original Solomon's Temple. And as I mentioned before, Solomon just means sun man, and it is simply an allegory, and it is Masonic, not Jewish, even though Jews have basically taken over modern Freemasonry. Let me clear my throat. What this brief history documents is that the founders of our nation, Washington, Franklin, Hancock, to name it just a few, were intimately connected with and philosophically descended from these original knights who fought against the Islamic forces in the Crusades over a half a century before across the Middle East. They were in fact so enamored with Templar rites and traditions that they made sure that our own Declaration of Independence was ratified on July 2, 1776 and signed July 4, 1776 on dates of overwhelming significance to this order, older Templar order. Cigarette went out, hold on. In other words, for some, America could easily be viewed, especially by any fanatic followers of Islam, as the literal embodiment of their oldest enemy of Allah, a literal infidel Knights Templar state. In light of this little-known history, there were other unusual numeric coincidences surrounding the New York and Washington attacks, which now seem highly relevant. How about the Templar Order's date of official recognition by the Vatican, 1118 AD, which, when added, 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 8 equals another 11. Now, do you remember, as we asked earlier, that there were 9 Templar original knights involved in the founding of the order, which, when added to the previous Templar founding date, equals 9-11. Which brings us to this crucial year of the 9-11 attack, 2001. There are exactly 883 years between 11-18 and 2001. And these, when added, 8 plus 8 plus 3 equal 19, which was the exact number of hijackers on the aircraft. The reason this latter number is important, and was quite obviously also carefully planned by the architects of the terrorist assault, is to be found in several scholars' recent discovery of a remarkable pattern of 19s throughout the Quran. In the view of many modern Islamics, the scientific discovery of the code of the 19s provides the final proof of Allah's direct revelation of the Quran. This section is called the Code, Simple Facts. Though the code was initially discovered by examining the occurrences of Quranic initials in the initiated chapters, in the initialed chapters of Quran, there is a large number of much less complex parameters to the code. Here is a brief list of some of them. Number 1, there are 114 chapters in the Quran, or 19 times 6. Number 2, the total number of verses in the Quran is 6,346, or 19 times 334. Number 3, then you add the 30 different numbers which are mentioned in the Quran's text, in other words, one God, two brothers, etc. The total is 162,146, or 19 times 8,534. Number 4. The first statement in Quran is, "In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful." And that consists of 19 Arabic letters known as the Basmala, B-A-S-M-A-L-A-H. It prefaces every chapter except chapter 9. Number 5. Though missing from chapter 9, exactly 19 chapters later, the Basmala occurs twice. Chapter 27 has this statement at the beginning and in verse 30. This makes the total number of times the Basmala occurs in the Quran 114, or 19 times 6. Number 6. Since there are 19 chapters between the missing Basmala and the extra one, the sum of those chapters numbers, the sum of those chapter numbers is a multiple of 19. The sum of any 19 consecutive numbers is a multiple of 19. The same of 9. The sum of any, this says 19 consecutive numbers is a multiple of 19. Well, let me put it this way. Any number times 9, the sum of the digits the answer to the multiplication, I forgot the term for it. I'm rusty on my math. The sum of the digits is equal to 9. So 1 times 9 equal 9. 2 times 9 equal 18, 1 plus 8 equal 9, 3 times 9 is 27, 2 plus 7 equal 9, 4 times 9 equals 36, 3 plus 6 equal 9, 5 times 9 is 42, and I'm sorry, not 42. So, but anyway, I'm not going to go through all of them. You get the point. You can pull out your calculator and do them yourself. It's not that I forgot my multiplication tables, but since I'm not going to bore you with it, as long as you know it, then there you have it. Again, the sum of any 19 consecutive numbers is a multiple of 19. Now that is interesting. But the total, 342, is also the exact number of words between the two occurrences of the Basmala in chapter 27. This number, 342, is 19 times 18. Number 7. Every word in the Basmala occurs throughout the Quran a number of times, which is a multiple of 19. Number 8. The very first revelation that was given to the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, came as 19 words. The total number of letters, number 9. The total number of letters making up the 19 words of the first revelation is 76, which equals 19 times 4. Number 10. Though they were the first revelation, these verses are placed at the beginning of chapter 96. This chapter is atop the last 19 chapters. Number 11. Chapter 96 consists of 304 Arabic letters, or 19 times 16. Number 12. The last chapter revealed, which is chapter 110, has 19 words, and its first verse is 19 letters. Number 13. God's name in Arabic, Allah, occurs in the Quran 2,698 times, or 19 times 142. Number 14. If you add the numbers of the verses where Allah occurs, the total is 118,123, or 19 times 6,217. Number 15. The main message in the Quran is that there is only one God. The number of times that the word one is used to refer to this concept of one God is 19. Number 16. The word Quran occurs in 38 different chapters, or 19 times 2. Number 17. The total number of times the Quran is mentioned is 57, or 19 times 3. Number 18. Within the 114 chapters of the Quran, 29 of them begin with the Quranic initials discussed earlier, intermixed between the first initial chapter, which is chapter 2, and the last initial chapter, which is chapter 68, are 38 non-initial chapters, or 19 times 2. Number 19. In that same group of chapters, from chapter 2 to chapter 68, there are 19 alternating sets of initialed and non-initialed chapters. Number 20. The total number of verses making up this group of chapters is 5,263, or 19 times 277. Number 21. Within this group of chapters, there are also 2,641 occurrences of the word Allah, or 19 times 139. Of course, that leaves 57, or 19 times 4, occurrences of that word outside of this group. Number 22. If you add the chapter and verse numbers of the 57 occurrences of Allah outside the initial selection, the total is 2,432, or 19 times 128. Number 23. There are a large number of discoveries having to do with the numbers of the chapters and verses. Many of them are very complex and interrelated. Here is a simple one to give you a feel for these discoveries. If you add the numbers assigned to all the chapters, plus the numbers assigned to all of the verses, plus the number of verses in the Quran, the total is 346,199, or 19 times 19 times 959. Number 24. If you look at the initial chapter separately and add the chapter numbers, verse numbers, and number of verses, the total is 190,133, or 19 times 10,007. Of course, it follows that the total for the uninitial chapters, 1,566,066, is also divisible by 19. Now, you'll notice there's no decimals in any of those. They all worked out evenly as something to do with 19. Let me clear my throat. At this point, we were beginning to see a serious pattern, a highly disturbing pattern with a unique Templar Islamic signature, indicating that this striking series of coincidences, the symbology surrounding the 9/11 attack, in fact, may have been a meticulously planned, been as meticulously planned as the attacks themselves. Since the Freemasons are now considered by most scholars, if not by Masons themselves, the Templars' direct lineal descendants, it only makes sense that the perpetrators of this crime, in their apparent hatred of America, would choose a target or targets that had some symbolic link through the Masons to the original Knights Templar order. In fact, they did. But before we get to that, it is necessary to study and understand just who the adversary truly was that fateful September day. Now, again, this is going to be the mainstream story, but it's still rather interesting. But what I'm going to do here, we're almost an hour into the show, so I'm going to go on back to the studio here and give my voice a little bit of a break and play another song. And I'm going to go ahead and use the Clannad theme tonight. So we'll play another Clannad song.
Tell me what you need to place the screen.
Okay. Now, who they say the adversary is. Osama bin Laden, widely believed to have been the mastermind, with possible help from the Iraqis, which of course we know now is bullshit, and of course we know bin Laden was bullshit, of this vicious surprise attack, is a well-established figure in the radical Islamic terrorist community. The son of a wealthy Saudi oil and construction magnate, bin Laden has forsaken all the privileges his family's wealth and stature have provided him in favor of his escalating anti-U.S. campaign. In news coverage of these events, bin Laden has frequently been described as a modern-day Saladin. I don't know if that would be a good description, but anyway. Yes, the same great Islamic general who defeated the Templars at Hattin, a modern recreation of that general in his current holy war against the United States. If you remember, Bush declared this was a holy war, or a crusade rather, same thing. And of course, I think that was a slip of the tongue, but it aroused a lot of people. However, bin Laden is far from a military commander or general. His methods are not those of an honorable warrior, but of a cowardly and murderous assassin. With all due respect to the producers of the television show called The West Wing, there's far more to this story than they had time to tell. I think I watched that maybe once. You know, it was just so much just garbage. But nevertheless, the original assassins were a quasi-religious sect of murderous defenders of Islam formed in 1090 by al-Hasan ibn al-Sabah, the same period that the Templars in the Catholic Church began their ill-fated attempt to retake the Holy Land in the Crusades. According to the Islamic scholar Edward Berman, author of a book called The Assassins, Holy Killers of Islam, though founded in Egypt, the order soon moved to a mountainous region of Persia, which is modern-day Iran, organizing their campaigns against the invading knights from a well-defended castle called Alamut, A-L-A-M-U-T. According to Berman, the cult was a ruthless, closed, secretive, even occult society, one that used murder, guerrilla warfare, and at times overt military conquest to achieve its aims. The assassins were much feared and paradoxically simultaneously admired by the Templars during the Crusades for their almost mystical ability to strike at any time and without warning and against any target, their almost inhumane willingness to sacrifice their own lives for the cause they were fighting, sound familiar, made them a fearsome enemy. Now, the word assassin has a correlation to hashish, and I think I will get into to that topic at another point where I discuss the Crusades and the Templars and the Assassins and the Sufi and all that good stuff. But the Templars learned a lot of occult information that was incorporated into Masonry and Western secret societies as well. So they have the Arabs to thank for that, because the church had destroyed much of that and hoarded it in the Vatican, never to be seen again in a Western world. According to the famed explorer Marco Polo, who visited Alamut in 1273, the assassins used a variety of techniques that we today would call mind control to obtain and indoctrinate new members. These reportedly involved the use of drugs like hashish and the transfer of the recruit to a sumptuous garden filled with beauty, feast, and women. In this drug-induced state, the recruit on waking was convinced that he had literally gone to paradise. Upon his return to the real world over time and at the hands of artful teachers, the recruit's original beliefs in Islam were replaced with a perverted version called the Nazari Ismailis, which ultimately convinced him he could return to this paradise by means of sacrificing himself for the cause and its leaders. Internally, the leaders of this sect refer to it as the New Propaganda. Readers who have studied bin Laden should now recognize many echoes of this 12th century Ismailis cult and bin Laden's fanatic 21st century followers who apparently carried out the fatal September suicide missions holding similar bizarre Islamic beliefs. Clearly, according to a document discovered by the FBI in one of the hijackers' bags, the hijackers were convinced that the single act of carrying out their mission would get them back to paradise, a striking parallel to the assassins' original beliefs. This, of course, is in stark contrast to traditional Islam, which teaches that suicide is a sin against Allah and that one must live an exemplary life to return to heaven. This underscores one of the many puzzles of this increasingly paradoxical event. How supposedly devout Muslims, some of the suicide pilots and their henchmen, were seen drinking and carousing at strip clubs the night before the attacks. The answer, like the brainwashed members of the original 12th century assassins, the suicide hijackers also did not believe that they needed to follow the traditional external teachings of Islam to get to heaven. They had a shortcut. Eventually, the assassins were driven out of the Holy Land, only to retreat to Afghanistan and Pakistan, precisely where bin Laden now has his base. In fact, perhaps subtly referring to this ancient heritage, bin Laden calls his current worldwide assassin network Al-Qaeda, which means the base. Eventually, the assassins were driven out of the Holy Land, only to retreat to Afghanistan and Pakistan, precisely where bin Laden now has his base. Okay, I'm sorry, I already said that. The scrolling in my mouse here slipped a little bit. I'm reading this as an email, by the way, not a web page. So I've got this little box that I'm reading in, kind of like what I did last night on the show. You know, I have this little small area, and there's very little use of the whole screen. Modern Afghanistan, after they finally defeated the invading Soviet Union in the 1980s, was taken over by a fanatic religious revolutionary government called the Taliban, which translates from Arabic as Students of God or Allah. This revolution, which began as a religious weapon, a jihad against the Soviets, with the direction and encouragement of both the CIA and the Pakistani Intelligence Service, ISI, was subsequently taken up and is now quietly being continued by a series of Islamic madrasas, M-A-D-R-A-S-A-S, or Muslim religious seminaries, in both countries. It is here, according to the New York Times reporter Jeffrey Goldberg, writing in the summer of 2000, that the next generation of bin Laden's brand of assassins is even now being quietly trained. The secret of the Taliban, the secret of Talibanism, is not found inside the shrine of the cloak of Muhammad. The secret is embodied in the two 11-year-olds cocking their fingers at me and in the taunts of their students in the mosque who raised their hands for Osama bin Laden. This is a quote, by the way. And in the person of the Mullah Haji Muhammad, my 17-year-old minder in Kandahar, who has no interest in any book but the Quran, and in the hundreds of thousands of young men like him at madrasas across the Pakistan and Afghanistan. These are poor and impressionable boys kept entirely ignorant of the world, and for that matter, largely ignorant of all but one interpretation of Islam. They are perfect jihad machines. And that ends what his quote. Protected by the Afghanistan's Taliban, it is apparent that bin Laden sees himself as leading a new generation of Islamic fanatics to be molded into modern descendants of the ancient assassins in a continuation of the 900-year-old holy war against the hated infidels of the Crusades almost 1,000 years ago, the Templars in their ultimate creation, the United States. Now, see, try and tell that to some Christian, and they just don't get it. Just in one ear and out the other. It's like the deer in the headlights look. At least, you know, even though this author accepts the 9/11 story as told. Now, of course, this may have been, I think it was written before enough evidence came out to prove otherwise as well. You know, at least this guy has got some knowledge of factual history and factual information. Let me clear my throat real quick. Okay, a war to be prosecuted this time using, among many weapons, naked fear and terror against innocent civilians, the slitting of the flight crew and passengers' throats aboard these aircraft, and the allowing of last-minute terrified cell phone calls from the hijacked planes, which was all total bullshit, of course, was obviously designed to be an unmistakable reminder to those in the know of the fearsome signature of the assassins. Other weapons in this new, actually very old war, subterfuge, disinformation, the planting of sleepers in the enemy camps, enemy camp years before, etc., a campaign of escalating terror clearly now being planned with a final global outcome in mind. So as you can see, and I'm interjecting here, you know, you can clearly see that the people who did 9/11 had to have all of this thought out, and not just the numbers, but they had to be aware of all of this history. And it's just amazing how that was all ultimately pulled off. But you know, if you have hidden occult information that the public doesn't have, which obviously these people do, and I've said that before, you know, they have a occult knowledge and they use it against us. In specific, they have astrological knowledge that is unavailable to the public. That is probably their greatest tool of knowledge that they use against us. Okay. In this role as a modern Al-Hassan ibn al-Sabah, in addition to using his great inherited wealth to underwrite this now literally global network, bin Laden is recognized even by his enemies as a devious and highly educated mastermind, and one with a determined long-term plan. But recent evidence has surfaced that a major part of that plan may not be the sole creation of bin Laden, but a shadowy figure known as Ayman al-Zawahiri, a highly educated medical doctor and bin Laden's right-hand man. Al-Zawahiri also began his terrorist career in Egypt, being a young medical student when he first became involved in a plot called the Muslim Brotherhood to kill then-President Nasser in the 1960s. Later, he was put on trial and jailed for 3 years for being part of Islamic Jihad's successful plot to kill Nasser's successor, Anwar Sadat, in October 1981, surfacing in Pakistan in 1987, where his medical training was used to aid Afghani resistance fighters to the Soviet invasion. That's where he first met bin Laden. According to CNN terrorism expert Peter Bergen, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and I'll never say it the same exact way twice, influence on bin Laden has been profound. According to a number of people who know both men, he helped him become more radical, more anti-American, and more violent. According to Bergen's sources, this is because al-Zawahiri has a vision of an apocalyptic conflict between Islam and the West. In other words, an Armageddon war, the last jihad. Mustafa al-Amin, a contemporary authority on Freemasonry, in his book Al-Islam, Christianity and Freemasonry, notes that during the period of the Crusades, many of the ideas and practices of the Muslim groups were adopted by European Christian warriors. More specifically, it was through the Knights Templar that most of the Eastern secret society's methods were introduced to Europe. The Templars were influenced by the Order of the Assassins. Al-Amin goes on to observe that the assassins, when carrying out their missions, took great pleasure in the actual killing, believing that the victims, in dying, gave up their gnosis, or life force, to their assassins. Given this background, it was still astonishing for us to discover an unmistakable signature, unequivocally linking the millennial-old Order of the Assassins to the horrific events of September 11, 2001, because if you take the current year, okay, apparently this was written in 2001, if you take the current year 2001 and subtract the year Al-Hassan ibn al-Sabah founded the Assassins in 1090, you get 911. Obviously, whoever was behind this modern horror wanted us to specifically and unmistakably connect the unique and ancient Middle Eastern secret and warrior society, the Order of the Assassins, with this specific 9/11 event. Further, as previously noted, they also wanted us to realize that this is also the only year, being 2001, that the addition of the numbers in the year of the founding of the Knights Templar, 1118, or 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 8 equal 11, plus the number of founding knights in the Templar order, 9, give the same identifying number, 911. It should now also be obvious that the same someone who meticulously planned these attacks also wanted it known that there was a major nexus between their planning and the Templars, between the date of the Templars' formation in 1118 and that first crusade which brought them to their secret excavations on the Temple Mount, and this one date, September 11, 2001, and an unequivocal fundamental connection between the Templars and the Assassins themselves. There is historical evidence pointing to the Order of the Assassins being present at the seminal Battle of Hattin in 1187, where the Knights Templar were resoundingly defeated. Is it coincidence that the term assassin in Arabic signifies guardians, and that some commentators have considered this to be the true origin of the word? But guardians of what? How about whatever the Templar Knights defiled through their non-Islamic excavations under Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem in 1118 and brought first to Europe, then to Scotland, then west? So, yeah, they're aware of everything being sent to the Americas. As we dig deeper, it became apparent that many additional layers of sophisticated assassin Templar symbolic fingerprints have been deliberately encoded in this tragedy. The real mystery, to what end? Even conventional news organizations have noted some of the more superficial symbolic aspects of these strikes, calling the twin World Trade Center towers and the Pentagon symbols of America. They are, of course, correct, but it is clear that beyond the now much-used cliché, they're the heart of the financial and military power of the United States. These media pundits simply do not understand what these objects, especially the Twin Towers, are truly symbols of at a far more fundamental level. Take a drink of my Monster energy drink here. Just one second. Yes, it is also true that the Pentagon is the heart of American military prowess and pride. It makes sense as a target if the aim of the assassins was to put doubt into the minds of the enemy, just as their ruthless predecessors did with the Templars so many centuries ago. But again, why the twin World Trade Center towers? And why not, if your aim is to strike at the financial center of America, take out the entire New York Stock Exchange? The reason the Twin Towers were so inviting targets to radical Islamic fundamentalists like bin Laden was that they were symbols, first and foremost, of America's Masonic Templar roots. It was no accident that these particular buildings housed the financial center of the free world. They represented the Templars' little-known invention of the very international financial system that has enabled the United States to become the global superpower that it is now. This legacy, again, stemmed from whatever the Knights succeeded in retrieving from the Temple Mount in 1127, that it was something of enormous value, both financially and culturally, seems apparent in their subsequent reception across Europe. When news spread of the Templars' success in their retrieval operation, history records that the Knights became revered by one and all. And in spite of their newly acquired Jerusalem wealth, major donations also began flowing in from all other quarters. Suddenly, no price seemed too high to secure identification with the Templars. According to one writer, within a decade of their return, the Templars were probably the most influential body the world has ever known. Nonetheless, despite the prodigious holdings of the order, the individual Knights were still bound to a vow of poverty. Whatever the situation in life, every Templar was obliged to sign over title to his possessions. Even the Grand Master, Hugh de Payns, had done so. Yet still the sons of nobility flocked to join the order, either as warriors in the Crusades or as traveling ambassadors and political consultants. Being so well funded, the Templars established the first international banking network, becoming financiers for the Levant and for practically every throne in Europe. Thus, in striking at the World Trade Center, whoever carried out the attack was striking not just at the political concept of America, but at the underlying financial aspect of the Templar legacy, a legacy overtly symbolized by the very nature of the twin World Trade Center towers themselves. In the mythology of the Freemasons Templars, one of the core legends is that of Jachin and Boaz, the twin pillars of Atlantis. All Masonic lodges have these two pillars at some location in their architecture. In the earliest lodges, they were said to represent far more ancient pillars supposedly erected by the children of Lamech, L-A-M-E-C-H. On those ancient pillars, one of brick and one of stone, were said to be engraved all of the then-known sciences to preserve them from destruction by fire or inundation. As such, they symbolized the esoteric importance of the knowledge of the builders, or the masons, art, to be guarded and preserved by future faithful craftsmen. Simply put, according to Masonic legend, the children of Lamech were the inhabitants of Atlantis. This information passed down from that prior highly advanced civilization is supposed to form the basis of the Masonic secrets from the ancient times. Hundreds of years later, shortly before the American Revolution, these original representations of ancient preserved knowledge were replaced in Masonic lodges with two brass pillars representing two similar pillars originally erected at the entrance to King Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem. The pillars of Jachin and Boaz, the new Masonic pillars, took on the symbolic attributes of establishment and strength, cleverly concealing their continuing representation of the great catastrophe which had destroyed a previous epoch of high civilization beneath additional layers of almost impenetrable, for most non-members, new symbolic interpretation. These same two pillars also make their appearance in non-Masonic religious works like the Bible. And in 1 Kings 7:21 it says, "And he set up the pillars in the porch of the temple, and he set up the right pillar, and called the name thereof Jachin, and he set up the left pillar and called the name thereof Boaz. And in 2 Chronicles 3:17 it says, and he reared up the pillars behind, and he reared up the pillars before the temple, one on the right hand and the other on the left, and called the name of that on the right hand Jachin, and on the name on the left Boaz. As the root source of the deepest Masonic secrets, the literal end of days and the Masonic role in the subsequent preservation and carefully timed re-dissemination of the sacred knowledge of mankind, these twin pillars, Jachin and Boaz, represent the most sacred objects in contemporary Templar Masonic rituals. Because of this, their symbolic incorporation into the towering 110-story Twin World Trade Center towers made those pillars, not the New York Stock Exchange, the prime targets of the Islamist assassins still waging their millennia-long holy war. If we could tie the actual architects of the World Trade Center towers directly to Freemasonry, we would have strong support for this aspect of our theory. To this point, however, we have not been able to do so. I forgot the architect's name. It's quite possible there is a connection, though. I could not see how these two could be there and not be that way on purpose. It just does not make sense. I'll have to research into that and report back. I just don't remember offhand. We do, however, have some fascinating circumstantial evidence, both from the architecture of the trade towers themselves and from their world-class architect. Ah, there we go. Minoru Yamasaki, Minoru Yamasaki, Yamasaki, Minoru Yamasaki. For some reason, that doesn't ring a bell. I don't know why. I know there's another Oriental architect that I'm thinking of, I.M. Pei. He's done buildings all over the West. He's done some in Houston and Dallas, and I think in New York, and just on and on. I just don't remember the specifics offhand. Let me clear my throat. There are a few very influential architects who sincerely believe that all buildings must be strong. And by the way, I do remember seeing this guy interviewed, and he went into the design philosophy of the building and all that, and of course the stories that were fed just totally conflict with what this man has to say. And by the way, if you haven't heard by now, I am somewhat of a member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I mean, I'm just like a peon. That's why I say somewhat a member. I'm not up there, and I'm not a licensed architect, so I have a lower position because I'm not licensed, so to speak. But if you are aware of my full name, and some of my listeners are, you can find my name as in that list of architects and engineers on their website, if it's still up. I'm sure it still is. And it mainly consists of architects, structural engineers, and civil engineers. Okay, the word strong in this context seems to connotate powerful. That is, each building should be a monument to the virility of our society. These architects look with derision upon attempts to build a friendly, more gentle kind of building. The basis for their belief is that our culture is derived primarily from Europe, and that most of the important traditional examples of European architecture are monumental, reflecting the need of the state, church, or the feudal families, the primary patrons of these buildings, to awe and impress the masses. This is incongruous today, although it is inevitable for architects who admire these great monumental buildings of Europe to strive for the quality most evident in them, grandeur, the elements of mysticism and power, basic to cathedrals and palaces, are also incongruous today because the buildings we build for our times are for a totally different purpose. Let me clear my throat. In And by the way, that paragraph I just read was by Yamasaki. And Paul Heyer, Architects on Architecture, New Directions in America, page 186. Let me clear my throat again. I didn't quite get it cleared. Okay, I think that got it. Yamasaki's discussion of incorporating qualities of grandeur, mysticism, power, as in the great cathedrals, into contemporary architecture is provocative, and this specific reiteration of the term strong remarkably echoes the very meaning of one of the pillars of Solomon's temple, Boaz, or strength. Even more intriguing, in the temple of Boaz was the left hand or northern pillar. In the September 11th attack, Flight 11 hit the northern tower first, thereby attacking the strength of America first. However, without an internal memo from Yamasaki's architectural firm directly admitting this intended symbolism in the choice of his two twin towers, we repeatedly admit that some will not see this crucial connection to the events of September 11th. So, how about some direct architectural evidence? Yamasaki, again, the chief architect of the towers, once described his search for architectural inspiration thus: I decided that I wanted to go back and find out what happened in the older buildings, you see. And once I got started on this idea of looking at older buildings to try to gain from them the qualities that we might instill in our architecture, then I got very excited, you see. And so I started with the cathedrals. In a direct comparison, the Gothic cathedral's fine architecture, Yamasaki, designed into the World Trade Towers, becomes startling and unmistakable in hindsight. The question is, was he trying to communicate something deeper than a mere physical resemblance? The great Gothic cathedrals of Europe were constructed over a period of about 200 years, from approximately 1134 to 1350, by Masons, ostensibly the same guild that would go on to become the foundation of Freemasonry today. And it was the same Templar Masons who were supposed have incorporated esoteric and secret geometric knowledge into the cathedral's basic construction, notes writer Graham Hancock. Let me light this and I'll read what he says. And by the way, Graham Hancock has done some interesting research and exploration and written some interesting books. Okay, this is what he says, and this is two paragraphs. At first, anyway. Saint Bernard, the patron of the Templars, played a formative role in the evolution and dissemination of the Gothic architectural formula in its early days. He had been at the height of his powers in 1134 when the soaring North Tower of Chartres Cathedral had been built, and he had constantly stressed the principles of sacred geometry that had been put into practice in that tower and throughout the whole wonderful building. Soaring roofs and arches been the distinguishing features of the Gothic architectural formula as expressed at Chartres and other French cathedrals in the 20th century, cathedrals that were regarded by some observers as scientifically far beyond what can be allowed for in the knowledge of the epoch. Louis Charpentier, The Mysteries of the Chartres Cathedral, that's where that came from. And Hancock goes on to speculate, what if in their excavations on the Temple Mount, they, referring to the Knights Templar, had unearthed scrolls, manuscripts, theorems, or blueprints relating to Solomon's temple itself? And of course, they didn't have blueprints back then. The way things were done back then was ink on cloth. You didn't make a mistake. Okay. What if these discoveries had included the lost architectural secrets of geometry, proportion, balance, and harmony that had been known to the builders of the pyramids and other great monuments of antiquity. And another paragraph says, in addition to their obvious resemblance to the soaring Gothic cathedrals that so obviously impressed Yamasaki decades before, what else was he trying to communicate through his choice of this particular design? Did he, like the Templar architects and masons who built the astonishing cathedrals 1,000 years before, also encode ultimate Masonic secrets in the tower's very forms? Well, I'm glad I'm going back and reading this before I get back and get into doing anything else on the Crusades or the Templars, et cetera, et cetera. I have not read this in years, and I've forgotten a lot about what this said. I knew this was rather interesting. Let me clear my throat. Paul hires architects on architecture, New Directions in America, page 194 through 195, contains the following description of Yamasaki's actual design of the Twin Towers. Let's see here how many paragraphs this is. Just one with another one in a few sentences. The structural system, deriving from the IBM building in Seattle, is impressively simple. The 208-foot-wide facade is, in effect, a prefabricated steel lattice with columns on 39-inch centers acting as windbracing to resist all overturning forces. The central core takes only the gravity loads of the building. A very light economical structure results by keeping the wind bracing in the most efficient place, the outside surface of the building, thus not transferring the forces through the floor membrane to the core as in most curtain wall structures. Now let me explain what a curtain wall structure is in case you don't know. All of these tall buildings that have a glass finish, they're just all glass. That's called curtain wall. There was a huge trend in curtain wall structures that began in the 70s, and it probably still goes on. It's just a little less common today than it was during the latter part of the 20th century. Now, see, the curtain wall structures, it's just glass. So that means you've got all these floors that have got to be supported inside the building, not from the outside. That doesn't mean that there's not structure as part of the exterior. You just can't see it because of the glass. It's there, but it's still, there are a lot of places where you have gaps in between where the floor is cantilever, depending on the way it was designed. Not all buildings are the same. Cantilever means something extends out over space below with nothing directly supporting it. A lot of times you'll see like a second floor is cantilevered out, like in a house or something, you know. Okay, where was I at? Office spaces will have no interior columns. In the upper floors, there is as much as 40,000 square feet of office space per floor. The floor construction is a prefabricated truss steel on 33 inches in depth. That spans the full 60 feet to the core and also acts as a diaphragm to stiffen the outside wall against lateral buckling forces from wind load pressures. And then they quote what he says here on these numbers. A prefabricated steel lattice with columns on 39-inch centers. As everyone who has followed our research should instantly recognize by now, 39 is none other than twice 19.5, or 19.5 times 2. However you want to phrase it, same thing. two towers, twice 19.5, creating a 39-inch separation of the steel. The floor construction is a prefabricated truss steel, only 33 inches in depth. That spans the full 60 feet to the core. And again, those of you who have followed our research will instantly recognize that 33 is not only the highest attainable degree in masonry in the Scottish Rite, and it is also, and more fundamentally, the sign, S-I-N, of 19.5 degrees. And that's a trig term, trigonometry. If you never took trig, then you might not know what it means, but I'm not going to go into trig. I only know a little trig. I didn't get real far in that, so didn't have to. 60, of course, is the critical angle in both equilateral triangles and the tetrahedra of which they are comprised, the latter incorporating those same critical circumscribed 19.5 degree angles. And by the way, I just know enough trig to do what I need to do, put it that way. In other words, it is overwhelmingly obvious that Yamasaki went out of his way to quietly, secretly incorporate key Templar Masonic geometric information in the most fundamental dimensions of the World Trade Center towers themselves by using these specific units, which are not metric and certainly not part of any imperial or English measurement system. There can be no other logical explanation for Yamasaki's bizarre choices for those specific numbers other than to enshrine Masonic secrets in his masterpieces and thus provide convincing proof of the Trade Center's ultimate symbolic role as the Twin Pillars of Solomon. Now, it seems like I said earlier, I think I mentioned that I saw some interview of him or something. I saw something on television. I don't remember what exactly it was. Maybe it was on YouTube or something. And there's nothing, he doesn't come out and say anything like, I'm a Mason or I incorporated all of these concepts into these buildings. I don't recall any of that ever coming out. However, he did say something along the lines that they had to allow for impact of planes into the buildings. Many of you know that a B-29, it may have been a B-17 bomber hit the Empire State Building in New York City. I think it was sometime in the 1940s. I believe it was during World War II or something like that. So this concept of flying planes into buildings is a bunch of garbage. And something occurred on a September 11th in South America in a covert CIA action that was on a September 11th, and I forgot what city and what building and what exactly happened, but a plane was flown into a building in South America. I think that may have been in the 1990s or 80s or something. I don't remember the details of that. So, you know, when they come out and say, we couldn't imagine this, that's all total bullshit. Okay, and on September 11th, 2001, these 110-story representations of Jachin and Boaz, incorporating through Minoru Yamasaki's quiet genius elements of Templar knowledge extending back at least 1,000 years, were finally deliberately and totally destroyed. The only surviving clue as to the hidden knowledge once incorporated in their towering construction being haunted proportions of the prefabricated steel lattice with columns on 39-inch centers. Another way to look at this extraordinarily well-planned and overwhelmingly successful terrorist attack against these major Templar symbols is in the context of the ritual alignment pattern we have been documenting for so long. As we have shown many times before, years ago we discovered that certain key events in our national space program have been repeatedly and consistently timed to occur around the placement of certain stars at key ritual positions in the heavens. Presumably, if Bin Laden, Iman, al-Zahari, or whoever planned these intricate assaults, understood this ancient ritual language, or their enemies, or were part of an equally ancient tradition which made use of similar knowledge for their own well-being. The September 11th events would also have been devised to incorporate these critical celestial elements in the attacks, if for no other reason than to confer a celestial advantage on their operations. And if this was indeed the case, then a carefully orchestrated and precisely timed sequence of events in the hijackings, routings, and eventual collisions of each aircraft with each target would have been required to successfully pull off such a multi-leveled interlocking plan. Such additional elements, because they all would have depended on precise timing with the rotation of the Earth, would easily and unmistakably show up in any post-analysis of the attacks. Another quick review is in order here. According to our system, the only stars of significance for the fulfillment of these rituals are Sirius, which represents the goddess Isis in the ancient Egyptian stellar religion, the three belt stars of Orion, which represents Osiris, her brother and husband, and Regulus, the heart of the lion of the constellation Leo. Leo is representative of Horus, the son of Isis and Osiris, who ultimately vanquished his father's murderer, Set. The only ritual positions for these stars considered significant are 33 degrees above or below the horizon, representative of the highest degree of enlightenment in the Templar Masonic rites, 19.5 degrees or below, above or below the horizon, taken from hyperdimensional physics of Cydonia on Mars, and the intimate geometric relationship of 19.5 to 33, and the horizon and meridian themselves considered markers of the passage between life and death. According to well-established timelines of the events from various media sources, the first plane, American Airlines Flight 11, struck the first tower at 8:45 Eastern Daylight Time. In checking the alignments for New York at that time, we found only one hit of possible significance. Sirius, the representation of the goddess Isis in the ancient Egyptian, and as we have asserted, Templar Masonic stellar religion, was just slightly above 32 degrees over the horizon. Now, 33 degrees is the position we normally consider a hit, and we normally only allow a half degree margin for error, so this was a case of close but no cigar. Still, it was close enough. A 1 degree error, plus or minus, is still one chance in 180. To be intriguing, since Sirius never really got as high as 33 degrees the entire morning. In checking the 903 impact of United Airlines Flight 175 with the second tower, we found that Sirius was slightly further out of range, though still very close. In quickly checking Washington, D.C. at the times of the tower impacts, we also found that neither Sirius nor Orion, as Osiris, the two primary players in the sacramental dance we have seen so many times, were close enough to any of the usual ritual positions. So, in neither of the targeted cities did there seem to be any irrefutable evidence that bin Laden, the assassin, at the times of the New York attacks, was trying to use the Templars' own magic against them. However, a cursory check of Giza, Egypt, the home of not only the assassins and al-Zawahiri, but also the Templar Masonic religion itself, showed the belt stars of Orion well within the half-degree margin of 33 degrees at the time of the first attack, and in Kabul, capital of Afghanistan, and bin Laden's al-Qaeda base, Regulus, the heart of the lion, was dead on the horizon, the western death horizon. The significance of Regulus on the western horizon at Kabul might be especially meaningful. Leo represents Horus, who was a figure of vengeance in ancient Egyptian tradition. If bin Laden saw himself as a vengeful assassin, then having Horus, the instrument of traditional Templar vengeance, on the death horizon of his adopted capital could be not only an ironic affront to the enemy, but a powerful source of magical power as well. Still, without the usual suspects in proper ritual positions over the targeted cities, We did not feel we could call these events as part of the normal ritual pattern we have come to recognize so well, nor could we use such a pattern, if it was absent, to ferret out precisely who was behind these despicable acts of September 11th. We needed more. We then looked closely at the actual flight numbers. The four planes involved were in sequence: American Airlines Flight 11, United Airlines 175, American Airlines Flight 77, and United Airlines Flight 93. As we looked at each of these, a disturbing and faintly familiar pattern began to emerge. Besides all the 9s and 11s, it did not escape our notice that the flight which crashed into the Pentagon in the only successful attack on Washington, D.C., was Flight 77. As we looked in the skies above the Pentagon at the exact moment of impact, 9:39 a.m., according to NBC's Dateline, and yes, we noticed, we saw something extraordinary. There, at precisely 39 degrees, literally in a row parallel to the horizon, were the three belt stars of Orion. Okay? So what? Okay. Now, I'm going to pause here for a second, and I'm going to play another song before I continue. And just to let everybody know, there's about 10 minutes or so left in the live show. And if you don't want to catch this in the archives, and I don't know yet whether I'm going to finish it tonight or not, we'll see. You can call in and just listen, but you need to call in before the 2-hour point of the show to be able to call in. Otherwise, your call will not go through. So let me get back over. Let me move this thing out of my way here. And let me get back over to the studio. And we'll play one more song, and that will give people a chance to call in or get yourself a drink or whatever the case may be. I'll be back shortly.
Thank you.
Okay. And we'll pick up where we left off. Okay, so what? Well, Orion, as we have said, represents the god Osiris, overseer of the dead, judge of the underworld and resurrection, the literal god of the dead, and the highest deity in the Egyptian pantheon of gods, so sacred to the Masonic Templar religion we've been tracking. To find Osiris, Lord of the Dead, at such a point overlooking this scene of death and destruction, the assault on the Pentagon, was surprising, if not disturbing. But again, it is at 39 degrees, so it doesn't quite fit our pattern of 19.5s and 33s, or does it? Readers will recall that in one of the earlier chapters of this end of days that they have been discussing here, we laid out our case that the location of Washington, D.C. at 77 degrees longitude was definitely no accident. What we did not discuss yet was that the latitude of the capital city was of equal symbolic significance to its longitude. That latitude? 39 degrees. The key multiple, again, of 19.5, which we now know was clandestinely embedded in the architecture of the World Trade Towers. The key code to figuring out the ultimate secret of the Templar magic. So this specific act, the crashing of Flight 77 into the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., with Osiris at 39 degrees above the site, was draped in the symbolism of bin Laden's Templar enemies. It literally encoded death to those at 77 degrees by 39 degrees, ergo death to the Templar state of America. If you need any more evidence that our Masonic founding fathers understood the significance of not only Cassidy and Steele's 77 degrees God's longitude, but also our own hyperdimensional physics, you need look no further than the architecture of our nation's capital for it. The architect of Washington, D.C., actually I believe that he was probably more of a civil engineer, since that's what civil engineers do, is lay out the, actually what happens is, let me give the process. You have people who are city planners, and sometimes city planners will, if they plan a new complete city, they can lay all of this out in a manner that is going to, all the property can be subdivided and all the streets are figured in and all of the infrastructure for the water, the sewer, and the storm sewer, one sanitary sewer, one storm sewer can be fixed in, planned, and the drainage and elevations, slopes, et cetera, can all be done. So anyway, that's for like planning a city. I wouldn't call this guy an architect, but anyway. Pierre Charles Le Effante was a French Freemason who was well acquainted with Benjamin Franklin from the latter's time in France. Le Effante cleverly encoded not only the Masonic symbol of the compass and the square into his design for our capital city, but also apparently an inverted pentagram, commonly considered an occult satanic symbol. The association of the pentagram with Satan is a fairly recent development, however. Actually, that's not true, but this author didn't know that. However, and the geometric symbol would have had a completely different meaning to a Scottish Rite Freemason like Le Enfante. Bullshit. In Freemasonry, the pentagram is found commonly in the inner chambers of the lodges. Its ancient origins are as a symbol for the star Sirius, inextricably linked through the Masonic lore to the Egyptian goddess Isis. As such, it has become the symbol for the Order of the Eastern Star, the female counterpart to the exclusively male brotherhood of Freemasonry. And by the way, the stars on the flag ultimately are symbolic of Sirius. And if you've ever seen the Star of Texas, and not just the outline pattern, but the internal lines as well, that is also the symbol for Sirius. And I found that out by accident one day. Anyway, shit happens when you're doing research. That's something I came across. It should be fairly clear at this point that the sacred 33-year cycle, calendrical longitude, 77 degrees, was picked up at the site of for our nation's capital for a major reason. I need to clear my throat. It should also be evident that the Masonic Order had full knowledge of this longitude's mathematical significance when they chose to place Two's District of Columbia dead on it. What evidence do we have beyond the fact that the cycle itself is coincidentally 33 years, that any of this was based on some secret knowledge of a physics that has its modern roots in the ruins of Cydonia? And again, Cydonia is on Mars. And of course, the nation's capital was a planned city, and the capital prior to Washington, D.C. was New York City, and of course the capital prior to that was Philadelphia. It's all in that 39 degree latitude. Certainly architects of a grand and covert plan such as this one would have carefully considered the site of their most crucial shrine, the very capital of the new Atlantis, based on more than just the longitude. Wouldn't the latitude of this all-important linchpin site reveal something about the selectors as well? Indeed it does. If there were in fact some hyperdimensional connection to the placement of our nation's capital, we would expect to see it revealed in its location in a significant way, and we do. Let's consider this for a moment. The most obvious way to encode such a message would be to place the city on an obvious tetrahedral latitude, but 19.5 degrees north by 77 degrees west would have placed the capital city off land and into the ocean off Mexico, to say nothing of the fact that this was territory that the English Masonic colonists did not control. Similarly, placing it at a latitude of 33 degrees north would have left them trying to build their city in the Atlantic off the coast of Georgia. So the only logical place George Washington could choose for this new Atlantean capital in North America, even if it was in the middle of a literal swamp when Washington selected the site, was where he eventually did place it, 39 degrees north. Huh? Just how is 39 degrees, not 19.5 or 33 degrees, tetrahedral or hyperdimensional? Well, if you remember from the preceding Trade Towers example, you simply divide 39 by 2 to derive 19.5. So since it was impractical for the founders to place their city where they clearly wanted to, at one of these prime hyperdimensional latitudes, they settled for the next best thing, a multiplicative harmonic of 19.5, 39 degrees. But they went further. The two main thoroughfares in Washington, Pennsylvania and Maryland Avenues, connecting the Capitol building with two other major landmarks, the White House and the Jefferson Memorial, depart the Capitol at exactly the key Templar Masonic angle of 19.5 degrees. And twice that angle, of course, equals 39 degrees. Again, the encoded latitude of Washington, D.C. There is other American precedent. This probably should be another. It says there is another American precedent in our investigation for this kind of geodetic Templar encoding. At the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, there are two launch pads from which all of the Apollo space shuttle and space shuttle missions have been launched. They are certainly the best known launch sites in the world to any space exploration buff. Pads 39A and 39B. Now, it's always bugged us why 39A and B instead of 39 and 40 or 38 and 39. The answer is that neither of these combinations is tetrahedral, as if to reinforce the point, the two pads are adjacent to a runway, the only runway at the Cape, runway 33. And lest you forget, the sign of 19.471 degrees, which is the unrounded 19.5, is 0.3333. And the cape itself, Cape Canaveral, translates in English as the Cape of Reeds. And what ancient Egyptian god was associated specifically with reeds? Osiris, of course. They may have just as well called it the Cape of Osiris. Starting to notice a trend here? Well, if not, you should be. Now, our cities will say that all of this is just a lucky coincidence, that we are applying magical thinking to pull connections out of thin air. But that's exactly the point. That is all about somebody's warped idea of magic. Is it really so hard to believe that the choice of locales for Washington, D.C. was based not on some random affinity for good swampland, but instead on the ancient and esoteric teachings to which all of these founders were demonstrably students, that this same sort of mathematical religious symbolism has simply continued another 225 years beyond the founding of the nation to the present day, just as it has for the many thousands of years of human history leading up to 1776. Why would 2,000 years of devotion to this kind of symbolic thinking simply stop at the doorstep of the 20th century and not find its way into many current branches of government, such as NASA, demonstrably dominated — how many top NASA officials and astronauts are Masons — dominated by modern devotees of these same ancestral organizations. One of the astronauts just died, I think it was yesterday or something. I don't remember if he was one of the ones who walked on the moon or what. But he was like 80 years old. Who really is reaching for an explanation here? Obviously they are. But there is still one task ahead of us, one final point that has to be made to tie all of this ritual history together and explain why it is intricately, inextricably connected to the horrifying political events of today. What's it all about? Why has all this been done? To what ultimate purpose? In the eyes of its founders, was this nation called by Lincoln the last best hope of mankind, truly born? Let me clear my throat here. We think the specific numerology of these attacks, the date, their timing, the flight numbers of the planes chosen, even the number of passengers and crew aboard each flight, was an encoded message and a warning from bin Laden to his Templar opponents. I understand your magic, and I can make use of it myself. But our theory would only apply if there were equal symbolism in the other doomed flights. And by the way, that would be pretty damn hard for somebody to pull off all of this stuff from the other side of the planet and not be an insider in any way. There's just no way. They're giving this bin Laden guy way too much credit, even if they didn't understand what we know about the event today. That's just nuts. I mean, how can you determine the number of people on the plane? We quickly turned our attention to Flight 93, the flight that crashed in the fields of Pennsylvania after a heroic effort on the part of the passengers to overcome the terrorists and keep the plane from being flown into the White House. Yeah, right. 93, of course, is an anagram for 39. The number also made us curious because 1993 was the year of the first attempt, apparently also by bin Laden, although Saddam Hussein's fingerprints were also left on the scene, to bring down the World Trade Center towers. So, of course, we went back to that initial event to see if it fit the symbolic pattern we've been tracking. And once again, the pattern was confirmed. 93 is also a significant number in magic. And remember what Sir Arthur has always said: any sufficiently advanced technology or physics is indistinguishable from magic. The so-called Thelemic practices of yet another modern-day descendant of ancient secret societies, the Magi. 93 was considered the literal number of magic itself, and the holy significance of this number was repeatedly espoused by Aleister Crowley, an early 20th century practitioner of magical rites. though which he hoped to bring about Armageddon. Crowley is usually seen as a marginal figure in history, but more recently he has been discovered to have had a significant, if unsuspected, role in the development of our own space program. And yes, he did. And maybe discuss that another time. But Flight 93 was important for an even deeper in retrospect, more obvious reason. For a moment, put yourself in the mind of the terrorist. If you have been given the task of destroying a specific target, like the World Trade Center towers or the White House, why wouldn't you try to quickly gain control of the airport? In the case of the two World Trade Center aircraft, this was in fact done. But Flight 77, which crashed into the Pentagon, was not commandeered for at least 45 minutes after takeoff. Flight 93, which was headed either for the White House or the state or the Capitol building itself, was all the way to Cleveland before being taken and turned around. Let me light the cigarette. It crashed around 10 a.m., more than an hour after the first plane hit the World Trade Center tower. So the question is, if you're looking to hit a key target, why wait? Why give the enemy the chance to figure out what is going on, scramble his fighters, and possibly knock you out of the sky before you reach your target? You don't. You get the jet as soon as you can, and you head directly for oblivion. The only reason to wait is if you're waiting for a specific time. Like, say, when a certain star is in a certain position over your intended targets. And even more to the point, why hijack 767s or 757s? They're big planes, yes, and they got the job done, but why not grab 747s? They have much larger fuel capacities and would do a lot more damage just because of their sheer size, unless they didn't have the right flight numbers that fateful morning. So if Flight 93 had not been taken out by the passengers, when would it have arrived in Washington, D.C., its presumptive target, using a maximum speed of around 500 miles per hour, probably around 10:20 a.m., and what did the sky over Washington look like at that moment? Orion or Osiris at the Masonic altitude of 33 degrees. The ritual pattern continued. It is perhaps not surprising that bin Laden would understand how to use these particular magical moments to plan his attack. These same rules of engagement have been used before by none other than President Bill Clinton, then representing the United States on bin Laden. Some of you will remember the August 7th, 1998 terrorist attacks on U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. These atrocities clearly proved to have been planned and carried out by bin Laden's al-Qaeda network, killed 224 innocent civilians and wounded thousands more. From the beginning, what was curious to terrorism experts in America was why they were two attacks simultaneously. In this case, it seems to be linked to the longitude of the targets, 39 degrees east in the case of the embassy in Tanzania, and just a shade off that for the embassy in Nairobi. And of course, 39 degrees divided by 2 is 19.5. So even then, bin Laden was telegraphing his coming attacks on Washington at 77 degrees times 39 degrees. In response, the U.S. launched a mostly ineffectual cruise missile attack on bin Laden's base camps in Afghanistan and simultaneously on the Sudan on August 20th. The location of the Afghanistan attack was fascinating. Bin Laden's terrorist training camps near the town of Khost at 33.3 degrees north. The target in the Sudan was supposedly a bin Laden nerve gas factory in the capital itself of Khartoum, a former bin Laden sanctuary. Later investigation revealed that the nerve gas factory was actually only making aspirin, and in no way connected with bin Laden or terrorist activity. So why did Clinton give the order secretly without even the input of the Joint Chiefs to take it out? Because it was located at 33 degrees east, and the precise timing of the attacks was at 13:30 Eastern Daylight Time, or 19:30 in Khartoum, and that's in military time. That's 19.5, in case you're interested. A few months later, after he kicked out the UN weapons inspectors, and evidence began to mount that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein was secretly stockpiling chemical weapons bullshit, the U.S. launched a similar attack on Baghdad. At first, this held little interest for us, but U.S. officials kept repeating over and over, clearly using a pre-planned talking point, that Clinton had ordered the attack at precisely 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on December 16, 1998. They kept repeating this, even when not asked ad nauseum. Obviously, there was a message here, and it did not take us long after we got the message to figure it out. When we checked the stars, we again found this the same all too familiar magical pattern. What this told us was that Clinton certainly understood the importance of acting with the grace of the gods in mind, the Templar gods, that is, and like bin Laden now, he certainly seemed to want somebody, presumably Saddam, to know about it. While we did not yet know if the current occupants of the White House are as up on all aspects of this magical symbolism, we are unquestionably sure that the previous occupants were. So what of yesterday's U.S. response to the attacks of 9/11? Yesterday's? They wrote this thing that quickly? Wow. Did Bush follow the pattern we have so carefully tracked in this first response of this new crusade against terrorism? Of course he did. One of the questions we've had to deal with over the years around this recurrent symbolism is the argument, even if you're right, it's meaningless, even if the alignments are real, so what? What use are they, other than to predict or espouse ostensibly linked events, posteri, meaning after the fact? We have always held that the alignment patterns are, at their core, hyperdimensional, inextricably linked to the ruins at Cydonia, as a shadowy reflection of a higher knowledge of arts, sciences, and physics that we as humans once commanded, of the magic that we once wielded, but we have not been entirely positive in some instances whether the planning or the incident came first. These September 11th events may have finally brought us to an appreciation of what these alignments really mean. A little reported story surfaced after the attacks of some astonishing electronic data collected by a research team at Princeton University on something called the Global Consciousness Project. In short, this is a project of consisting of 38 random number generators called RNGs located around the world, communicating their second-by-second random number data via the internet back to a central computer located at Princeton University. The team discovered on checking their data for September 11th that there was a stunning decrease in randomness, a literal non-random spike in their previous random numbers, beginning a few hours before the tragic event at the World Trade Center and extending several hours after. This completely worldwide occurrence showed unequivocally that there was indeed a confluence of events, or some sort of a spike in the background entropic noise of reality, a dramatic change that remarkably occurred precisely around the attacks. The phenomenon is flatly inexplicable by any conventional science. Let me take a quick drink here. By stark contrast, this extraordinary effect on the RGNs is easily explainable, if not inherent in, the hyperdimensional physics model. This starting September 11th data, startling September 11th data, is supported by a completely independent set of Russian experiments conducted over the past 40 years, which have found equally non-random repeating cycles in such supposedly random processes as radioactive decay. These two studies taken together all but destroy the notion that physical and biochemical processes are simply probabilistic. In fact, the mere existence of such data is a flat refutation of the current reigning view of quantum physics as strictly probabilistic random process. It does, however, provide startling explanation for a looming problem underlying all of quantum physics, the baffling violation of the so-called Bell inequalities. These are the experimentally observed violations of the normal set of quantum mathematical relations that would rule out the ability of distant quantum particles to exert influences on each other at seemingly instantaneous or faster than light rates. The hyperdimensional model not only provides an elegant explanation via a literal higher dimension of space-time for such otherwise inexplicable faster than light communications between fundamental particles called quantum entanglement, it demands that time windows exist for less susceptible masses above the quantum level within which this same hyperspatial communication also can occur in cycles. When the hyperspatial geometries dictated by the positions, rotations, and momenta of the solar system's planets create increasing and decreasing gating opportunities on Earth for this instantaneous information transfer of increased coherence between dimensions. The working model of the Princeton experimenters is that the shocking events of September 11th triggered a massive tremor in the force, that the major decrease in randomness of their random number generators placed around the planet was a direct result of the linked consciousness of billions of people all over the world reacting to that horror seen on television. We respectively disagree. In our model, the dramatic change in the random numbers coming into Princeton, beginning 4 hours ahead of the event, was a direct result of a change in spatial parameters around those far-flung generators. These changing parameters, in turn, were caused by an increase in the information transfer rate between dimensions caused by a particular spatial geometry between Earth and key celestial objects. It was into this precise hyperspatial window that the modern assassin methodically drove the aircraft, attempting with military precision, as we have seen, to use the horror and revulsion of the literally billions watching live on television to effect a direct change in the consciousness of humanity around the world, directly assisted by the physics. Remember what Mustafa al-Amin said about the assassins. They take pleasure in stealing the gnosis or the life force from their victims. In other words, they use conscious application via these critical celestial alignments of a practical hyperdimensional magic literally thousands of years old. Support for this hyperdimensional interpretation of the Princeton results comes not only from their own long-term RNG data, which reveal many similar spikes going back years with no globally riveting events in training a mass consciousness within those windows, but also from a detailed analysis of the September 11th events themselves carried out by Dean Radin of the Noetic Sciences Institute. Radin did a detailed instrument-by-instrument analysis of all the 38 random number generators deployed by Princeton around the world, seeking to discover if there was any distance dependence from New York and Washington in the observed non-random instrument effects. What he discovered was absolutely fascinating and totally supportive of the hyperdimensional celestial window model, but not of a mass consciousness effect. Radin discovered that the effect of the 38 RNGs was not uniform around the planet. Those generators specifically located in the Western Hemisphere exhibited increased non-randomness within the window compared to others in the Eastern Hemisphere, and of those, the ones in North America exhibited still more divergence from strictly random behavior, and of those, the instruments on the East Coast exhibited the most divergence from their expected random behavior. These effects are not characteristic of any other consciousness experiments that have been conducted over the last 70 years, ranging from early examinations of precognition, clairvoyance, and telepathy in the classic Rhine experiments at Duke University in the 1930s to the remote viewing experiments carried out at SRI for the CIA decades later to astronaut Edgar Mitchell's famous clandestine ESP experiment conducted literally halfway to the moon. Uniformly, all positive consciousness effects from these experiments have seemed completely unaffected by simple distance factors, noted one recent review of the field. I'll clear my throat. No known energy seems to fit the facts of clairvoyance and telepathy. Radiant energy appears to be the necessary stimulus. X-rays, radio waves, gamma rays, etc., have been advanced as a possible cause for the phenomena in question. However, all these types of energies lose efficiency through distance and are affected by intervening objects, conditions which seem to have no appreciable influence on extrasensory perception. To say that these minds are attuned to each other, the mass consciousness effect, is a facile phrase, but it is merely an analogy and explains nothing. We may as well face the fact that the science of physics at the present time has contributed little to an adequate understanding of the nature of the extrasensory perception. These and the Princeton RNG's results are, however, totally consistent with the geometric celestial alignment effect, peaking on September 11th, just as Flight 11 was precisely timed to hit World Trade Tower 2 at the height of the geometric window. Note the slow buildup of non-randomness beginning days earlier, highly indicative of a slowly changing astronomical window effect, and the additional statistically significant non-random second peak 2 days later, when there were no major new terrorist events or obvious reasons for a resulting mass consciousness effect. This data, however, is remarkably supportive of an enhanced hyperdimensional transfer rate, decreasing the normal random. Princeton's RNGs through temporary increased coherence in the machines. If we now use a combination of the alignment model and the data depicted in the Princeton graphs, it is entirely feasible that a calamity like what took place at the World Trade Center and in Washington might be predicted or even prevented in advance, if only we knew where to look and what to look for. Such new studies at Enterprise, which is this organization, are ongoing even as we write. How's that for a practical use of the alignment model? I'm going to go ahead and play one more song here, and I think I should be able to get this wrapped up afterwards. We're going on 2.5 hours at this point, and I can tell that we're getting near the end, so this should be a one-show job on this article here. So let me get back on over to the studio and play another song. And let's see here. We'll play this one. Okay. Ultimately, this led us to look at the symbolism around the last in terms of recounting, not in terms of the actual impact times of the four flights. On the surface, United Flight 175, other than having 65 people on board, 6 plus 5 equal 11, didn't seem to fit this numerological pattern, 1 plus 7 plus 5 equal 13. But, as we have seen, since all of the previous flights contained deep symbolic significance, obviously now carefully planned by the assassins for their maximum magical effect, we intuitively felt that 175 somehow had to share in this common crucial pattern. Then it struck us. What if the redundant 11s and all throughout this process also referred to an arrogant prediction, keeping in mind with the ancient rules of engagement of such secret societies of the next attack, like the 11th month, and what if 175 was really 17.5, like noon on the 17th of November, which we subsequently discovered just happens to be noon on the first full day of Ramadan, the holiest period of the year for Muslims around the world. What if we were supposed to look to Mecca, the holy city of Islam, where at least 1 million pilgrims would be gathered in the Hajj at noon on that specific day? The more we thought about it, the more the scenario began to worry us a lot. From a variety of reports, bin Laden is thought to possess at least one suitcase nuke purchased after the breakup of the Soviet Union, a small tactical device that can devastate a major city. We had a stunning thought. What if, as his next act, bin Laden used a device in Mecca at the height of Ramadan on his own people? Who in the Muslim world, especially if there is a highly visible military response to September 11th from the United States and Afghanistan on CNN between now and then, which unfortunately kills Afghani civilians, would believe that anyone other than the great Satan, the United States, was responsible for such a heinous act? What Arab state would or could deny bin Laden at that point his worldwide jihad, the holy war with the West that he and Amin al-Zawahiri so fervently desires? What would the Muslim-dominated southern republics of the former Soviet Union do? Armed with thousands of nuclear-tipped ballistic missiles, they could vengefully turn against the United States in retaliation for the unspeakable crime against all Islam. What would the Muslim-dominated government of Pakistan do? Armed with their newly developed, thought more limited arsenal, though more limited arsenal is what it should say, of equally dangerous rocket-borne nuclear weapons. Now, of course, as we know, the Russians rounded up all of those weapons. I don't remember when, but it could have been either right before this or after. I don't know, but they rounded up their weapons. They didn't just leave them in their former satellites for them to have. That would be nuts. So we looked and found absolutely nothing. But what if Mecca wasn't the target on that date? What if the target was somewhere back in the United States, like Washington again? So again, we looked. Noon in Mecca on the 17th is 4 a.m. in Washington, D.C. At precisely that moment, Sirius, the goddess Isis, the most important single star in this Templar Masonic religion, will be at exactly 33 degrees elevation with an azimuth of exactly 195 degrees, a decimal harmonic of 19.5, a celestial alignment which eerily will be an exact duplicate of Sirius's alignment for Washington, D.C. at the height of the September 11th attack in Princeton's Peak. According to this striking window in November, what is being planned for the 17th, if anything, will either come from Washington or be aimed at Washington in this time period, and it will not be trivial. Neither scenario is very pleasant to consider. From previous pieces of this pattern, which now assume a striking new importance, just keep thinking Princeton, we must also not forget that there is a small but powerful lobby in our own government that wouldn't mind such a literal Armageddon script playing itself out. And we know that bin Laden and his cohorts want and need something equally devastating to inflame the entire Muslim world into jihad. We hope that by publicizing this potential set of scenarios now, we can foil whatever secret plans there are, if any, to escalate this war on terrorism into total global devastation. And even if the 17th comes and goes and nothing happens, there still will be other windows coming. We must seriously start looking now if we are to evade what somebody's obviously designed by launching September 11th, the final war for all mankind. And we must not forget that the president sees himself as something of an Horus Avenger. By all press accounts, George Walker Bush has no great passion for being president prior to his election, and some say even after, other than fulfilling a sense of duty to avenge his father's political death at the hands of Bill Clinton in 1992 by vanquishing Clinton's hand-picked successor, Al Gore. In light of the Middle Eastern history we've laid out here, and his being sworn in on the same Templar Masonic Bible used by George Washington over two centuries before, George Bush's use of the word crusade repeatedly in the days and weeks following September 11th attacks can only have been deliberate and intentional and aimed directly at bin Laden and his assassin band of cutthroats. We now know where the term came from, don't we? What we all must hope in the weeks and months ahead is that Mr. Bush does not become so blinded by his newly found sense of destiny, the belief that he has been literally chosen by God to lead the nation in this hour of crisis, according to some close advisors and friends informed and shaped by the president's own strain of Christianity, that he falls into bin Laden's carefully laid assassin's trap of escalation to the ultimate final war. Let me clear my throat. Well, we all know he's not a Christian. He was asked if he was a Christian once, and his response was something along the lines of, well, if you're asking if I was born again, then the answer is yes. But most Christians don't understand what born again means. So, nevertheless, we are at the end of the article. They say here, take care, Mr. President, the game's afoot, and you may not know as yet all the rules of this new, but in fact very ancient war, but it's obvious you are learning. And that ends this article. So, anyway, I hope everybody enjoyed that. It was rather detailed, and a lot of liberty went into the potentials, of course, but you got to see some things that were definitely thought out before all of that was planned. There's just too much coincidence there for a good portion of that to not be. You know, whether or not there were any of these planes with passengers on there, that's what the report said. So, anyhow, I'm not going to get into this issue of this particular thing or that particular thing about this, the events of 9/11 or how they did this or how they did what, or did the plane shoot down that other airliner over in Pennsylvania, just blah, blah, blah. You know, everybody has seen all of this stuff ad nauseum. So, needless to say, you can make your own conclusions on those things yourself. So, I'm going to go ahead and close this show out and do it before they wind up cutting me off prematurely, which can happen sometimes once you get over 2 hours. So, we'll go back to the studio here. And I think I went too far when I scrolled here. Almost there. Hold on. And we'll play one more song to go out. And I'm not sure what my next show would be. It may be something on the paranormal. Or it could be something else. I just don't know yet. So, anyway, let's see, which song did I play here before? Well, I'm not sure now, but I'm kind of clonotted out anyway. So I'm going to play some Collective Soul to go out with. I think that would be okay. So until next time,